dollars to reconstruct Syria. And so he is trying to be docile with the West to a certain extent, with the Gulf countries who are going to give the money, and has been trying to avoid any confrontation with Israel. It will be to be seen to if that strategy will work. Israel doesn't want his government to be successful, has been trying to fragment Syria, has offered some up to $1 billion to the Druze so that they develop some form of autonomy and oppose the Syrian regime, has been also communicating with the Kurdish population in the north. But at the same time, Trump and the West want to end the war in Syria and want the new government to they want to pull away the new government from Iran and its sphere of influence. So he is managing all these tensions and contradictions, and it will be quite a challenge for him to succeed. It's going to be, I think, a major challenge, economic, political, and geopolitical as well.
Yasser Munir, Syrian scholar and sociology professor at Emerson College, author of The Syrian Revolution. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us.
This is Ursula K. Le Guin, and you are listening to KBOO, the cheerful voice of social conscience, KBOO, Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The nominating committee meets on the second Tuesday of the month at 6 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting virtually can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
You're listening to KBOO's All Thrills, No Frills Volume 4 Special Programming Campaign. Check out all the great special programs we're bringing you now through April 15th at kboo.fm/ATNF4.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, a judge blocks the attempted deportation on legal U.S. resident and student activist Mohamed Khalil. Washington lawmakers consider tax reforms to take the burden off low-income families. And in international news, former Philippines leader Rodrigo Duterte is arrested and flown to the International Criminal Court for trial. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, March 11th, 2025. I'm Eric Leuschner. A New York federal judge has blocked efforts by the Trump administration to deport Mahmoud Khalil, a Palestinian student and activist at Columbia University. The ruling stated, quote, "To preserve the court's jurisdiction pending a ruling on the petition, petitioner shall not be removed from the United States unless and until the court orders otherwise," end quote. Khalil helped a student protest movement demanding a ceasefire in Gaza. He was arrested Saturday night by federal immigration authorities. They said they were acting on a State Department order to revoke his green card. Khalil was among those under investigation by a new university committee that brought disciplinary charges against dozens of students for their pro-Palestinian activism. Trump is cracking down on pro-Palestinian demonstrations on college campuses. The arrest comes days after he vowed to deport foreign students and imprison agitators involved in what he claimed were illegal protests. Khalil's lawyer, Amy Greer, said, quote, "ICE's arrest and detention of Mahmoud follows the U.S. government's open repression of student activism and political speech, specifically targeting students at Columbia University for criticism of Israel's assault on Gaza. The U.S. government has made clear that they will use immigration enforcement as a tool to suppress that type of speech," end quote. Khalil is currently being held at a detention facility in Louisiana. Khalil had emailed interim university president Katrina Armstrong the night before his arrest, requesting her help in securing legal support and following what he described as a, quote, dehumanizing doxing campaign against him, end quote. He said people were falsely labeling him a terrorist threat and calling for his deportation. It's not actually clear what he is being charged with. Legal experts point out the only person who has authority to revoke a person's immigration status, including student visas or a green card, is an immigration judge. Green card holders have broad rights as legal residents of the United States, including the right to work and protection by all laws of the United States. The process to apply for legal relief can drag on for months. Camille Mackler, founder and executive director of Immigrant Arc, a coalition of legal service providers in New York, said, quote, "There is a question of whether due process is going to happen here or for anyone else. We are seeing the Trump administration use the power of government to go after people or institutions they do not like or agree with. In a free society, that shouldn't happen," end quote. Deporting a green card holder is rare, and the process is often tied to other immigration charges, including lying on the application or having ties to a terror organization. Khalil's attorney said in a statement, quote, "He was chosen as an example to stifle entirely lawful dissent in violation of the First Amendment. The government's objective is as transparent as it is unlawful," end quote. The former leader of the Philippines, Rodrigo Duterte, has been arrested and flown to The Hague to be tried by the International Criminal Court, or ICC. For more, we go to KBOO's Doug McVeigh.
Former Philippine President Rodrigo Duterte was arrested Tuesday, March 11th in the Philippines on a warrant from the International Criminal Court for crimes against humanity. Duterte was then put on a plane bound for The Hague, where he will stand trial. Rodrigo Duterte was president of the Philippines from 2016 to 2022. Prior to that, he had been mayor of Davao City. Duterte is charged with crimes against humanity for thousands of murders committed in his name by police and quasi-official death squads while Duterte was in office. Authorities in the Philippines claim that only about 6,200 people were killed by police during drug raids under the Duterte regime. According to local observers and international human rights organizations, however, the true number of police murders during that period is somewhere between 12,000 and 30,000. Reporting for KBOO News, I'm Doug McVeigh.
New legislation in Olympia seeks to reform Washington's regressive tax codes, taking the burden off low-income families. Isabel Charlet has more on the story.
A package of legislation in Olympia aims to reduce growing wealth inequality by reforming Washington's tax code. With the nation's second most regressive tax system, the state relies heavily on sales and property taxes, which do not take income into account. Critics say the system overburdens low and middle income families while benefiting the wealthy and corporations and adding to the state's revenue shortfall. Alana Maynor of the nonprofit Rural People's Voice notes that low income families pay 14% of their income in taxes, while the wealthiest pay just 4%.
You don't have to convince anybody in rural Washington that somebody has a foot on their neck. We know things are unfair. We know that people at the very top have got to start paying their fair share.
Critics of making Washington's tax codes more progressive say the state has enough money, it just needs to spend it more efficiently. Corporations in Washington avoid paying taxes for social programs on salaries above $170,000. One piece of legislation would close this loophole, which supporters say could generate around $4 billion for Washington's social programs like paid family and medical leave. Maynor says the changes are about leveling the playing field. She points to the Affordable Home Act, which would lower the tax rate for most Washingtonians when they sell their homes, while raising rates for homes that are sold for more than $3 million.
That's getting people who sell multi-million dollar homes to contribute a more reasonable amount of taxes compared to most people that live around me who are selling mobile homes or manufactured homes.
Data shows that in the last 20 years, the amount of money families need to get by has increased faster than Washington's median earnings, up to 2.5 times in Clark and King counties. Maynor says she speaks to a lot of people who are stressed about the cost of living, groceries, and health care. She says people in Washington deserve better.
And the only way that working class people are going to get there is if our legislators step up and make sure that there's a fair playing field in our tax code and our policies.
I'm Isabel Charlet, Washington News Service.
Oregon households that rely on the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP, have an extra 2 weeks to request replacement benefits after the February snowstorm. SNAP helps low-income Oregonians buy food. If that food is lost during a storm or other extreme event, folks have limited time to request replacement benefits. People who use SNAP and live in the Willamette Valley on the Oregon coast, in southwestern Oregon, or in Hood River, Deschutes, or Klamath counties can apply for replacement benefits until March 26th. More information on how to request replacement benefits is online at oregon.gov/ODHS. The day that Robert F. Kennedy Jr. was confirmed as Secretary of Health and Human Services, President Donald Trump established the Make America Healthy Again Commission. Advocates say they're concerned about Kennedy's approach. Nadia Ramlagan has the story.
Temperatures are rising among some advocates who are warily viewing the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s approach to reforming the nation's food and agriculture system. The Trump administration has also established the Make America Healthy Again Commission, which says it's aimed at addressing the chronic disease crisis. Sarah Sorcher with the Center for Science in the Public Interest says she feels the Trump administration is intent on dismantling the federal government.
It's hard because to some extent, we're aligned with RFK Jr. in recognizing that there are problems with the corruption system, and FDA hasn't been good enough at its job to protect consumers.
Kennedy wants to target certain food additives that are given special exemptions and can be added to food without FDA approval. Yet the Trump administration recently cut numerous FDA staff members. And the Deputy Commissioner for Human Foods, who led the ban on red dye number 3, resigned last month. Farm Action Fund, the legislative arm of the nonprofit advocacy group Farm Action, came out in support of Kennedy earlier this year, arguing the issues he has raised have not been at the forefront of agricultural policy in decades. But Sorcher believes the administration's hacksaw approach to reforming the federal government will backfire.
I think this administration still has not learned how to do that, and it's actually moving us in the wrong direction.
Experts say the new Secretary of Agriculture, Brooke Rollins, is not expected to tighten regulations on corporate interests and has been taking the advice of the Department of Government Efficiency to cut, not add, programs. This story is based on original reporting by Nina Alcotti for Sentient and is part of a collaborative reporting project exploring a just and climate-friendly food system. This is Nadia Ramlagan for Kentucky News Connection.
House Democrats won't back the GOP budget bill. Ontario reacts to Trump trade moves by enacting energy export tariffs. And a new report finds mass deportations don't help the labor market. With more on the story, it's Edwin J. Vieira with 2025 Talks.
Welcome to 2025 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
The House Republican so-called spending bill does nothing to protect Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. Quite the opposite. The Republican bill dramatically cuts health care, nutritional assistance for children and families, and veterans' benefits.
Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries says House Democrats won't support the stopgap measure to fund the government through September. The bill increases defense funding but cuts non-defense spending to 2024 levels. President Donald Trump is backing the bill, saying it'll provide Congress an opportunity to get national finances in order. A vote on the bill will be held today to avoid a partial government shutdown beginning Friday at midnight. Jeffries says Democrats also want guarantees in any budget deal and debt limit increase that Congress controls spending and won't be unilaterally overruled by the White House. While many Americans may feel the pinch of reduced federal funding and benefits cuts and worse customer service, Washington, D.C. will see its impacts more directly. The stopgap bill omits a provision to let the city spend the remainder of its 2025 budget, instead forcing it to reduce to 2024 levels, like any other government agency. D.C.'s non-voting House Delegate Eleanor Holmes Norton calls it fiscal sabotage.
The CR would result in a projected cut of $1 billion, which would force dramatic reductions in essential services the city provides, including D.C. police, EMS, and schools.
Meanwhile, in response to Trump's trade moves, Ontario is putting a 25% tariff on electricity exported across its southern border, hitting New York, Minnesota, and Michigan. Conservative Ontario Premier Doug Ford discussed the situation with CNN.
Uncertainty is what people don't like hearing in general life, not to mention the markets are tumbling, and investors from around the world are looking twice at America and Canada to invest in.
Ford says he's considering terminating these exports as the U.S.-Canada trade war progresses. Trump has delayed or eased some tariffs, but has refused to rule out a recession, sending the stock market down sharply. Some economists say if a recession occurs now, the country could recover before 2026, which could buoy Republicans in the midterm elections. Trump and his congressional allies say extending his tax cuts could boost economic confidence. A new report finds U.S. presidents have a long history of blaming immigration for the country's economic troubles, even when research shows the opposite. University of Colorado economic professor Chloe East says mass deportations and raids incite fear and leave vacant jobs that U.S. citizens are unlikely to fill.
We really don't see this substitution between unauthorized immigrants and U.S.-born workers in the way that we're promised we will by politicians. In fact, the effect sort of goes even beyond this lack of substitution.
Previous research has found migrants are more likely to start businesses and create jobs than native-born people. I'm Edwin J. Vieira for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to the KABU Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for KABU News In-Depth. At 6 o'clock, it's This Way Out. Then at 7, Civic Cipher. Tonight's weather will be rainy with an overnight low of 41 degrees. Tomorrow's weather will be rainy with a high of 51 degrees. Today in history, in 1973, the first formal meeting of PFLAG, the Parent, Families, and Friends of Lesbians and Gays, was held in New York. It would go on to become the largest family and LGBTQ ally organization in the U.S. The quote of the day is from English author Douglas Adams, known for writing The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. He said, quote, "There is a theory which states that if ever anyone discovers exactly what the universe is for and why it is here, it will instantly disappear and be replaced by something even more bizarre and inexplicable. There is another theory which states that this has already happened." The Trump administration cuts to diversity, equity, and inclusion programs is having an impact on funding and projects for Native tribes. With that story and more, it's Brian Bull with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Brian Bull, sitting in for Antonia Gonzalez. The Trump administration is cutting DEI, or Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion programs. NWPB's Lauren Patterson reports on how that's affecting funding and projects for tribes.
Kylie Probert is a descendant of the Spokane tribe. She grew up in the Northwest and went to college in Washington and Oregon. She landed in Washington, D.C., and in September, she got her dream job, helping oversee grants for tribal communities through the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services.
I wanted to help tribes. I wanted to make a difference in government.
Last month, Probert was fired. She was one of thousands of federal workers whose jobs were terminated during their probationary period. She was managing more than a dozen grants to help tribes across the country.
There was a big push to cut diversity-related projects at HHS. And of course, a lot of my work with tribes fell into that bucket.
The projects were temporarily halted, and Probert says she has no way to verify if the work will be restarted or renewed. Rather than feeling deterred, Probert says she feels reinvigorated, and she still wants to make a difference in public health. That could mean going to an Indigenous law school or finding a new job in health policy. I'm Lauren Patterson, reporting.
A project bringing solar energy to the Wind River Reservation has hit some road bumps due to pauses in federal funding. But as Wyoming Public Radio's Hannah Haberman reports, the team is searching for other ways to move forward.
Energize Wind River is poised to set up standalone solar systems and bring electricity to roughly 40 Eastern Shoshone homes. But
the but would be that our construction funding is currently on hold pending review.
That's project director Levi Purdom. He says about $2 million of funding is paused. Even though the project has funding for training, employees, and outreach, it's unable to buy or install the solar equipment. Purdom is optimistic that the funding will eventually come through, But for now, the group secured a $20,000 grant from the Nature Conservancy.
They wanted to support our non-governmental fundraising efforts. So the intent is to hire and fund a fundraising specialist.
Energize Wind River still plans to start construction this spring if they're able to raise enough money. Other tribal nations across the Mountain West are facing similar issues amid budget cuts by the Trump administration. I'm Hannah Haberman.
A Native photojournalist is promoting the idea of a national land-back movement across the U.S. for territory ceded, stolen, or taken during colonization. Joe Whittle is a member of the Caddo Nation of Oklahoma and descendant of the Delaware Nation. A former backcountry wilderness ranger for the U.S. Forest Service, Whittle says he's proposing that the federal government return its public lands to its original inhabitants.
Based on the fact that the United States violated every Indian treaty they ever signed with indigenous peoples, and essentially my project proposes that tribal citizens come together and form a class action lawsuit to sue for damages due for our treaty violations.
Whittle's argument just appeared in Time magazine. He's hoping an inspired attorney might take the federal government on.
There's also an ecological argument based on our traditional ecological knowledge and a lot of data that shows that indigenous people are better and more sustainable stewards of the land than private industry or the United States government has ever been, due to how deeply embedded in U.S. politics private industry has become on public lands.
A presentation and discussion on Whittle's land back proposal will be held Tuesday night at the University of Oregon in Eugene. This is National Native News. I'm Brian Bull in the KLCC studios in Eugene, Oregon.
Water experts are speaking out about the biggest draw on freshwater worldwide, agriculture, specifically crops used for cattle feed. Suzanne Potter has more on the impact that has on climate resilience.
Fresh water available for human use only makes up about 1% of the water on Earth, and 86% of it goes to irrigated farms. So experts say in a time of water scarcity, agriculture is going to have to cut back. The agricultural industry is the largest user of fresh water, making up nearly 70% of global withdrawals from rivers, lakes, and aquifers. Brian Richter with the nonprofit Sustainable Waters says the majority of water on irrigated farms goes to raise crops used for cattle feed.
So that includes corn silage and sorghum silage, but the dominant crops that are being irrigated in the western United States are alfalfa and grass hay.
Richter adds there's no effective control over the total volume of water that gets used, so rivers are drying up, greatly affecting wildlife. And aquifers are being depleted, causing the ground to sink in some places. Richter predicts that about 20% of existing farmland in the water-stressed western U.S. will need to be retired. So policymakers, water managers, and farmers will have to make hard choices.
You set a cap on the total amount of water that can be consumed from each water source. Another important strategy is shifting from water-intensive crops to crops that don't require as much water. We refer to that as crop shifting.
Another way to ease pressure on global water resources would be to encourage people to eat less beef. This story was produced with original reporting by Gabriella Sotelo for Sentient. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
As cases of the avian flu increase nationwide, hurdles for surveillance efforts persist, and federal changes threaten to dismantle any progress made to contain the virus. Fewer than 100 cases have been confirmed in humans nationwide, but experts believe current tracking and testing methods fall short in some states. Ruiz Branch has more from Chicago.
The avian flu is now being detected in humans, and concerns about inadequate testing and tracking methods, along with its pandemic potential, are mounting. But federal oversight remains in limbo, leaving Illinois and other states to navigate independently. At least one person has died from influenza A or H5N1, and almost 70 others have been infected. Public health officials say those at highest risk are farm workers, but that could change since the virus has already mutated, spreading from poultry to cattle. Dr. Megan Davis at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health says the potential for asymptomatic cases of this flu subtype can make tracking it a challenge.
We suspect there are more, but of the ones that are confirmed, we have only three where we don't
have a known animal exposure.
Davis adds if the virus mutates to be transmissible among humans, that would be a big concern. In Illinois, only cases in wild birds and poultry have been reported so far. Health officials are urging frontline workers to wear proper protective gear to avoid infection. The CDC looks to states to help monitor outbreaks, but state efforts are inconsistent. Some health departments rely on doctors to decide when to test a person, while others are urging them to actively screen patients. Davis says growing government distrust complicates the issue, especially since the majority of people infected have been poultry and cattle workers, many of whom are migrants.
So when you have migrant and immigrant workforces who may distrust authority, you also potentially have workforces that lack access to healthcare.
And being undocumented could deter workers from reporting symptoms or seeking care, she adds. Others live in rural areas without many healthcare options. Meanwhile, more federal changes to policies and protocols could hinder tracking efforts. One safety proposal for more worker protections from infectious diseases is on hold. For Illinois News Connection, I'm Judith Ruiz Branch. This story was produced with original reporting from Nina Elkady with Sentient.
Now we go to global citizen commentary from Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. He says President Trump displays extraordinary ignorance about the world. His territorial demands, indifference to facts, and bizarre handling of international trade manners are putting America last, not first. As Martin Luther King once said, quote, sincere ignorance and conscientious stupidity are dangerous. The opinions expressed in the following piece are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone. One criticism of Donald Trump that should get more attention is his ignorance about the world. Geography, history, culture, language, economy. He frequently makes questionable decisions and eyebrow-raising comments that reveal his insularity and his insensitivity to others. Such comments also undermine the best interests of the United States. Here are three ways in which this president is at his worst in foreign affairs. First, of the truly mind-boggling demands of other countries, that Denmark sell Greenland to the United States, that Canada consider becoming the 51st state, that the Gulf of Mexico be renamed, that Panama be returned to the U.S., these demands are as legendary as his campaign claim that Haitians in Ohio are eating their dogs and cats. Sheer stupidity. Second are statements by Trump that, as Dana Millward puts it in a Washington Post column, display astounding ignorance. His example, quote, on his first evening back in office, Trump invited reporters into the Oval Office, where he discussed his new decree that NATO members must spend 5% of GDP on their militaries. He singled out Spain and went on to criticize Spain for being a member of the BRICS. That's the organization of BRICS, Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa. You know what a BRICS nation is, said Trump? You'll figure it out. Well, Trump needs to figure it out, since neither Spain nor any other NATO or EU country is a BRICS member. I'm guessing that Trump hasn't the slightest idea which countries are in BRICS or what BRICS is all about. But by God, he's going to slap 100% tariff duties on Spain. A third ignorance zone for Trump is international economics. He got his BS in real estate at the Wharton School, but is best remembered by a professor who said Trump was, quote, the dumbest student I ever had. Trump repeatedly lies or errs about tariffs, insisting that they are a cost to the exporting country. He should be forced to listen to Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau's explanation of how tariffs will hurt us, not them. In imposing new tariffs on Canada, Trump evidently forgot that autos are part of a supply chain that links Canada with the United States. The major Michigan auto manufacturers had to plead with him to reconsider the tariffs, which he did, ordering a one-month pause. Then he jerked away the tariffs on Mexico and Canada until early April. Someone must be whispering in his ear about the costs to U.S. consumers, including his supporters of these tariffs. Perhaps someone also reminded Trump that he signed the U.S.-Mexico-Canada trade agreement, hailing it at the time as one of the greatest trade agreements of all time. So to conform with that agreement, about half the goods imported from Mexico and 62% of Canadian goods will face the tariffs. But that was yesterday. Tomorrow can always bring a wide swing of the pendulum, and it did. Trump announced the day after the one-month pause of a 250% tariff on Canadian lumber and dairy products, matching Canada's 250% tariff on U.S. dairy exports. So much for the U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement. One trade expert said, there may be a method to the madness, but he didn't see it. This on-again, off-again tariff policy is indicative of serious brain malfunctioning, an arbitrariness that liberals should be spotlighting. Trump's spat with Canada is particularly illogical. His supposed concerns about fentanyl and migration are surely not the explanation, since a minuscule amount of fentanyl and exceedingly few illegal migrants cross the border to the U.S. So why is Trump bent on a trade war with Canada? Personal pique over Canada's refusal to sell itself to the U.S.? Whatever the reason, these latest tariffs will cause Wisconsin dairy farmers dearly and the U.S. home building industry dearly, just as the auto tariffs will eventually cost Michigan dearly. That hardly squares with putting America first. We can say an explanation of Donald Trump's behavior that he lacks empathy, has no guardrails, is unpredictable, is mean-spirited, or simply has bad judgment. But the bottom line is simpler. He's a stupid man. A clever propagandist, yes. A cunning negotiator, yes. But ignorance is at the heart of the matter. Martin Luther King is supposed to have said, "Nothing in the world is more dangerous than sincere ignorance or conscientious stupidity." No one fits that description better than Donald Trump. He never took advantage of his privileged youth to educate himself about how the world beyond the super wealthy lives, or about the nationalism that frames other countries' perspectives. We see how, as president, he leads an insulated life. Very few trips abroad, and certainly not to developing countries. No welcoming parties for Africans or Latin Americans. No interest in other countries' music, art, or literature. He's about to preside over the closure of numerous U.S. embassies and consulates abroad, mainly in Europe, because in his judgment, saving money is more important than having outposts to monitor and report on developments and serve foreigners interested in the U.S. or hoping to travel here. He, and Elon Musk as well, are deaf to any purpose other than personal gain. America has never had such a poor and dangerous representative of who we are or hope to be. I'm Mel Gertoff for the Global Citizen. Thanks for listening.